Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Ruthie's Table 4, a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios.
Some weeks ago, Ian Wright and his beautiful family were sitting here in the River Cafe garden, celebrating Nancy, his wife's birthday. Ruthie, the waiter said to me, please go and ask him to do a podcast, especially for all of us. We know he loves to eat, but we want to know more about him. He is our hero. Ian does a lot that I could never dream of achieving. For instance, kicking footballs into nets. But we do share a lot as well. Concern for healthy eating for children, advocacy for social justice, a more fair society, and an end to racial discrimination. Today on Table 4, we're going to get to know each other better, discussing all this and more, including having delicious lunches with our family. Thank you so much for doing this.
No, it's
and you're going to stay for lunch, are you?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Deep fried zucchini flowers. Okay. 12 male zucchini flowers, sunflower oil for deep frying. 225 grams plain flour, 4 tablespoons extra virgin olive oil, 300 millimeters of warm water, sea salt, freshly ground black pepper, 4 large egg whites. For batter, you have to sieve the flour in a large bowl, pour the olive oil into a well in the center and slowly stir with a wide spoon to combine the flour into the oil. See, these are the kind of things where, because I'm not a great cook, I'm nervous about this. You add a little warm water until the batter is the consistency of double cream. Like season and let it stand for at least 2 hours. Eat the sunflower oil to 180 centigrade. That's roast. Wow. Just before cooking, beat the egg white until stiff and fold into the batter. Yeah, and I was speaking to Louis.
Oh, yeah.
The chef. And he was telling me about how much he has to beat the egg whites up. So then when you know that they're done, you can turn it around and then they don't fall out, which I thought was pretty cool. So
put it over your head.
Yes, and it doesn't fall out, which is really cool.
Hi, I'm Louis. I'm a chef at the River Cafe, and today we're going to be making deep-fried zucchini flowers with Ian Wright.
Nice one, Lou. Looking forward to it.
So basically, what we've done is we've made a batter with 00 flour, olive oil, and some like ice-cold water, and then we'll fold through some whipped-up egg whites.
Yes.
So you want to whip them until they're, you know, stiff. You can hold a bowl up above your head, and they won't fall out.
Wow.
And that really helps to, like, puff up the batter and like makes them go, helps with like the crispiness. We get these amazing zucchini flowers in from Italy. They're really fresh, vibrant.
Yeah,
these would have been plucked off of the, you know, the crop within the last day or two. And we'll dunk these in the batter, fry them for a minute at 190 degrees, and then they're just really delicious with a big pinch of salt and a wedge of lemon.
When I first saw them, I was like, what are those about?
Yeah.
And then you taste them, they almost melt in your mouth.
Yeah,
they kind
exactly.
of like dissolve. You know, they're very easy to continue just eating them.
I only make zucchini flowers when we're in Italy, because you get them, we go and pick them from the garden.
Right.
And then we fry them. And
they're so beautiful, aren't they?
They're so beautiful. And I think it's what children really love to do, because ultimately it sounds perhaps more complicated than it is, because basically what you're doing is you're making a batter, folding the egg whites into that, and then you have the flowers, you dip them in, and I like very little batter on them because it's the flour that's so delicate. Mm-hmm. And then I don't know what 180 degrees is when I'm frying oil. So what you do is you just heat it for a long time, and then when you put the flour in, it sizzles.
Yes.
And if it doesn't sizzle, it's probably not ready. But so it does look like I have to probably write a new cookbook. So I'm prepared to do that. But tell me about your, because you do love to eat out, don't
yes.
you?
Yes.
I see you here, and you always seem so happy.
Yeah.
Did you eat out as a child?
No. This is probably why I love eating out so much. I didn't actually start eating out until, obviously, I think probably 21, 22.
Yep.
Didn't have a lot of experiences of going to restaurants and And even when I started doing that, I started eating pasta very late in my life. Yeah. There wasn't a lot of variety. It was a lot of West Indian
Fair
food.
Enough.
It was stew chicken. It was curry goat, mutton, tripe, pig's trotters, oxtail, white rice, rice with peas, boiled dumplings. So it was that kind of food all the way up until that point. And I remember when I started playing football with Crystal Palace, I used to get very nervous about going to, like, we used to have to go to hotels, we used to have to go to restaurants and communal eat, all of us together. And I was very insecure about it because I didn't know food. Yeah. So, and then we had older players who were really, they're quite mean. Let's say things like, you've got dauphinoise on there, you've got sauté potatoes, and they'd say things like, you don't even know how to spell dauphinoise. Mm. You know what I mean? Do you know what sauté potatoes are? Can you afford steak? Mm. So what I would do is I would end up then getting my mum to make me something. I'd go down so the boss would see me, and then I'd stay for a 5 minutes, and then I'd leave and get my food warmed up by the people in the kitchen, and I'd eat in my hotel room. And that's what we used to do when we was younger. We used to all eat either in the bedroom or in the living room in front of television or stuff like that. Yeah. So I was more comfortable doing that. But my problem was insecurity about ordering the food.
Yeah.
So, you know.
It's intimidating.
It was intimidating to the point where the manager, I've done it a few times, about three or four times, he didn't see me at dinner. And I remember in the morning, he said, where are you? I'm not seeing you at the dinner. That's our get together. And then I explained to him why. And then he kind of sorted that out for me. Mm. He had a word with them, it didn't help because obviously when people...
It's bullying.
Yeah, it was. It didn't help. But then I just blasted through it. And so off of the back of that, you start to, because you get into a situation where you can go to nice restaurants. Mm-hmm. And so when I love it.
So when you talk about being excellent at your sport, right? Being able to do what you do so well, and that you are on a team, and then going to a mealtime was painful.
Yes.
And it was painful because you were made to feel, unable to
feel
do
a bit
that.
Inferior, so, to be honest. I was 21. In fact, I just turned 22 when I joined Crystal Palace because it was very late for me. And a lot of my experiences started to come as learning on the job about mixing with people, different people, worldly people.
Yeah.
Even just the knife and forks from outside in, knowing what to do. You sit there and you're nervous. And so those were the kind of intimidating things about going to a restaurant or eating with people that used to really frighten me because I never.
Yeah.
We ate on our laps literally all the way through. And so it's obviously
was
like,
your mother working? Was it
No.
Was there a table where you could sit?
No, the kitchen wasn't big enough for a table for the four of us. So it was my mum, my stepdad, my older brother, me, and my sister.
Right.
So there wasn't enough space for all of us to sit and have that dinner and have that chat. We never done that.
Yeah.
That's something that's happened to me later in my life.
And your mother, you were describing though the food that probably cooked. Quite a lot of effort to cook. So would she cook that all day? Or would she have a job? And then
No, she didn't work. Mm. She didn't work, but she did cook the food, obviously, from the morning. The thing is, we didn't eat a lot of food. I didn't eat, like, breakfasty. Like, I could skip those, no problem.
Was that because you couldn't afford?
No, it would have been there, but, like, I wasn't used to having it, And we could literally go up and, you can have cereal if you want, or for lunch, you can have it if you want. But, I found that... Probably because I was out playing football all day or doing stuff all day. It didn't bother me to eat breakfast, eat lunch, but the dinner was something that was always there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very repetitious of everything that we always have. We had rice and peas and chicken on a Sunday. You had soup on a Saturday, mutton, curry goat, curried mutton and stuff like that, white rice and peas. And that is the diet all the way through. I didn't start eating pasta till I was like 21. Because when I was at school, you used to see little pasta bits that they used to have in school. Like you used to draw patterns around them. Mm. Fusilli and penne and all that sort of stuff. And so I didn't see that as something that we should be eating. You'd go to some people's houses and their parents would make macaroni cheese with the Sunday rice and peas. But my mum never made that. So I wasn't very good with anything that my mum didn't make. She didn't make a lot of vegetables for us. We used to get some callaloo. When we was younger, West Indian callaloo, like a green cabbagey thing. But I didn't eat a lot of stuff because school dinners for me were a nightmare.
Why were they a nightmare? It
was so bland. It was so plain. And everything that my mum cooked with a lot of seasoning. So this is why, as time went by, even when I'm sure we'll get onto it with Arsenal and Arsene Wenger, eating bland food is very, very difficult for me.
Is it?
It has to be seasoned or some form of taste. Yeah. You know, I need to have that. So, you know, that is something that my mum done a lot. And so anywhere I went to eat, if it wasn't seasoned properly, I could easily not eat the food.
Did you qualify for free school lunches?
Or? Yes, yeah. We did.
Yeah.
Which was obviously, it had its own drawbacks. But yeah. I was never bothered about being teased for that.
And you were teased for that?
Yeah, you teased for that. Because one of the things I always used to wonder why they did it was you had to queue up in a different line.
It's shocking. It's shocking. Yeah.
You know, and it was always, you know, you get people who, you know, kids are kids, aren't they? Mm. They just tease you and stuff like that. And what I used to get a lot of teasing for, because obviously I was quite good at the football at the time. So they'd find something that they can use against me to try and make me feel bad and insecure. And it used to work.
Horrible.
So some of the times I used to wait and wait and wait. And then I'd go and do it. And then if people tease you, you just get on with it, you know.
Was this an inner city school in London?
Yeah. I went to a school called Samuel Pepys in Brockley.
Right.
I loved the school.
So you did? Even though you had such...
Yeah, because like, you know, my friends, you know, and I could play football.
Yeah. If you have a skill. Yeah.
It was a thing. Because my problem was when I was younger was my attention span in the classroom wasn't very good at all. And when I couldn't grasp what they were doing, I'd get a bit disruptive. And
I think it's much more recognized now.
But then what they used to do is they used to say, if you don't start paying attention more, you're not going to be able to play football.
Oh, they'd punish you that way.
Yeah, and so that was another massive worry for me because it wasn't because I was just being disruptive for being disruptive. It's just I couldn't grasp
the
lesson as quickly as other people. Yeah. So, you know, now I understand it more. But like, the food, again, going back, one of the things I did love about school was desserts and afters because we never had anything like that. You might have had digestive biscuits when we were younger and chocolate biscuits every now and then, but it wasn't very, we didn't have them a lot.
Yeah.
You know, you go to your friend's house and they would have all sorts of like stuff in their larder in their kitchen, but we never had that. So school dessert, like school puddings, was amazing.
You know? What were they?
So apple pie. And custard, you know, because I didn't eat custard for a while because obviously I didn't have it at home, so I didn't like that. So I used to always have the sponge on its own. I used to have the apple pie on its own. Then you'd have the sponge with the jam and the coconut on the top of it, you know, an apple crumble. Honestly, I used to look so forward to it. And I remember I used to have a friend who used to give me all these sponges because he didn't like sponge. Mm. And then there was a time I used to give him all the apple pies and all that kind of pastry on. And then I remember one day I just said to him, I'm just going to taste it because I never tasted it, you know. And then I tasted it with the custard and I said, I can't give it to you no more. I like it
too. This is too good.
Yeah.
Did your mother grow up in poverty?
Yeah, she grew up, in Jamaica. It was very tough. Very tough. She grew up with like 7, 8 siblings. You know, it's quite tough. She had to move out and go and live with my aunt who didn't treat her very well. And that was one of the things as well. I didn't get to really find out the deep-rooted problems with my mum's, with my mum's like mental health and everything, what she went through. Because you'd be sitting down just watching the television and then, you know, my mum would just burst out crying. You'd just see tears just coming down her face. But as time went by, obviously, you know, people always talk about my stuff, my Desert Island Disc, and I tried to be as candid as I possibly could. But I just remember how she used to be, she was so sad inside. Kind of took it out on me and my brothers and sisters and that. But, like, never, ever spoke about what happened to her to the point where some of the time she spoke to me about her aunt and my cousin Ali, Alvin. Mm-hmm. Alvan, his name was.
Alvan.
Yeah, and his mum was she was really nasty to my mum.
Yeah.
You know, when she used to tell the story, she'd burst into tears talking about that sort of stuff. So
that kind of abuse leaves scars.
It does.
You know, and I think probably maybe the way... She had trouble expressing her love, as you spoke about, you know.
Well, the thing of it is, Ruthie, she always made sure there was a meal on there for us.
Yeah.
We didn't have, the greatest clothes in that, but the clothes were clean, everything was nice, you know, our house was presentable, everything was nice, but, you know, she just didn't have much.
Very tough.
Yeah,
very
it was tough.
You talk about your Jamaican family, your mother coming from Jamaica, leaving her family in Jamaica, or did they come with her?
No, they left.
They left. So she left.
She left.
How
home,
old
yeah.
was she?
She probably was when she came over. She came over in the Windrush generation. So she came here in, I think it's 58.
Right.
You know, so, and she came on her own.
How old was she?
My mum was born 1933. In fact, she might have been born earlier than 33 then, because like when she died, she was 94.
Right.
But like she came in that generation, you know, and she came and stayed with friends, and it just went from there.
So she had no family at all?
Not here, just like friends and acquaintances. Yeah. There was a couple of long-distance cousins who were here as well. They came in and around the same time. And so they met up. So this is why I grew up in and around Broccoli, Lewisham, Deptford,
right.
New Cross, all that. So that's where everybody
Did you ever go back to Jamaica? Have you been back?
Yeah, I used to go a lot. When I was at Crystal Palace in 85, you know, like I say, when I was able to afford to do that, because the first time I went on an aeroplane was with Crystal Palace. Yeah. You know, I just turned 22, and we went to Qatar. It was amazing.
Oh, did you?
Yeah,
really?
It was unbelievable. But we flew over the Alps and that. Yeah. And it was like, obviously the first time I was on a plane, I just couldn't believe it.
Were you frightened?
I was really afraid, yeah, because most of the trip I was thinking, how does this stay up? How does it stay up here?
I still think that.
You know, and I remember, like, again, like, we had those the older guys who, obviously, they knew, you know, this is the first time. All this experience was new to me. And, like, I think back on these experiences, and they were amazing, but like, it's always tinged with their nastiness because I remember one of the things that they said to me, which I'll never forget, was you have to be, you're most afraid when you're on a plane, 30 seconds before you take off and the 30 seconds before you land. And to this day, I still have anxiety about that.
Can I ask you if when you were started out, was the bullying, was it racist, do you think?
Yeah.
Were there other black players in the team?
Yeah, there was. Me, Tony Finnegan, Andy Gray.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Henry Houghton was there at the time as well. But yeah, the racism was pretty bad. It was accepted. It was nowhere near what it's like
so
now.
So the cruelty was from the white players?
It was from the white players and the older players. You know, obviously the younger guys who were in and around the same age as us sympathised with us. They didn't like it, but it wasn't a time where you could stand up to that kind of presence in the dressing room because those guys
would
experience. That would have been 85, between 85 and, you know, 85 until.
Yeah. Has it changed?
Yeah, it's changed a lot because now what's happened is that there's allies.
Yeah.
You know, black people don't want racism.
Yeah.
You know, if it was up to black people for racism to stop it, it wouldn't be there.
Yeah.
You know, but what you have to understand is that without white people, white allies, you're not going to shift it. You're not going to make a move on the dial.
Yeah.
And what's happening now is that there are more allies. There are more people who speak out. There are more people that now are more than willing to put their heads above the parapet and say things that you could never say.
One of the great, great memories, and I'm much older than you, but one of the really defining memories of my life was watching the Olympic Games in Mexico when the three runners took the salute.
Yeah, the salute.
And that taught me, I mean, my parents were already, you know, they went south, you know, the civil rights. My brother was arrested in Mississippi. We were very liberal.
Yeah.
Thinking family, but seeing the power of that salute. And their lives were ruined, by the
absolutely
way.
Ruined.
They never ran again.
Yeah,
you know?
Never ran again. When they went back, like, ostracized back in America. You know, it was a sad state of affairs, but, like, it was a tragedy, really. But when you look at what it done and that symbol and how powerful that symbol is, you know, you look at the guys now, they're taking the knee, the girls as well, where they're playing.
Yeah, yeah.
They're taking the knee and people say, well, it's run its course. It's got no effect. People are not taking it. What has, when you talk about racism, you know, what has had an effect? And you have to look at it and you have to say, you have to let people still know that you will stand against it. And this is what's happening now. You've got kids at their little football matches. They will take the knee. They'll do it on their little football pitches because they are aware of it. And that
changes.
That is how it changes.
Yeah.
You know, education is the way because if someone's ignorant to something, they're gonna be against it. When you teach them what's going on and they understand it, you can no longer be ignorant to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, racism is ignorance. If you reach people, teach people, they'll lose their ignorance.
When did you think it really started changing? Was it when they also realized that
George
black
Floyd.
Players were really important? There's recently.
I think when it really caught hold of the world. And people really started to say, well, enough is enough. Obviously, Colin Kaepernick taking the knee for injustice and inequality. But like George Floyd, the death of George Floyd really brought it to people's attention that, no, come on now.
Mm.
You know, come on.
Are there places that you wouldn't play?
In respects of, there's nowhere that I wouldn't play. because I feel that, again, you have to play. You know, I've been in stadiums where people have targeted you. Mm. I've watched my son being targeted, my friends. It's happened to me in stadiums in England and abroad. Mm. And there's no way I wouldn't play. But I must say that if I was playing now and it happened, like we're seeing it happen now, they should walk off. But you can't walk off yourself. Your team has to walk off.
Yeah. And would that happen?
I think that's going to happen at some stage. Mm. I think that's going to happen pretty soon. It's going to happen sooner rather than later because I feel like I say the allies and the guys, great people, Harry Kane, you know, Jordan Henderson, all these guys, Kevin De Bruyne, you know, great footballers, great white players who they won't take that and they will stand in solidarity with their teammates. And that is going to happen sooner rather than later because if I was playing now, I would continue to take the knee. Mm. And if I got racially abused on a football pitch, whether it is abroad or here, I would hope that my teammates would walk off with me because my character, my personality, I would do that now because the power is there to do it. But back in the day, it wasn't there. And you know what it's like? I saw just recently, there's a guy playing for Real Madrid who was getting like vilified, racially abused, Vinicius Jr. at Real Madrid. And you could see the pain he was going through to the point he just stood there and the tears just started to come down his face because he was being racially abused. He was the one that got sent off after being racially abused and the crowd were abusing him, called monkey chants and stuff. And what I saw with him when he stood there and the tears coming down is something that I've had to deal with myself because you're helpless. You feel humiliated. And like I said, there's nothing you can do. And so that feeling is something that, you know, you don't want people to have to go through, especially in this time, at any time, but especially in these times when we could do something.
There was a very long time ago, there was a presenter, you know, Michael Parkinson.
Yes.
And you've probably seen it on YouTube, but there was an interview between him.
Muhammad Ali?
With David Beckham and George Best.
Oh, okay.
George Best was comparing, or actually David Beckham very respectfully said, I'm not going to talk on this couch. I want, you know, George Best, he's the person we all want to listen to. And what he said was, you know, he came from poverty, or, you know, a very, very unprotected family. And he said there was no safety net for being famous. Mm. There was no safety net for being
he was the first
suddenly,
best,
and that now there is a safety net for players, of the big teams or who become celebrities, and that they're taken care of, they're looked after. And I think what you're saying is there may be now, they may have a safety net, but it might not include racism.
No, but it will, because you have to have that belief, because there's enough people out there fighting for it. Mm. You know, it's totally different when you look at what George Best went through, adulation, Beckham. We're looking at someone now who can have Jack Grealish. It's going through the same. You're just hoping that, you know, we saw what Gaza went through and how it kind of like, what the effects it had on Gaza. Mm. But when you're getting that kind of adulation, that kind of love, that can affect you in a certain way. I think David Beckham, obviously, you know, he's dealt with it very, very well. Yeah, unbelievably, unfortunately. Yeah. You know, Gaza, I didn't deal with it so well. George Best was the first, like the fifth Beatle. He didn't. Mm. He was paving the way, for, you know.
We were going to talk about Muhammad Ali. Well, yeah. You were going to when I asked you. And, you know, again, another hero.
No, the thing with Muhammad Ali, I remember when I was younger, it was the interview he had, and I even saw it again the other day with Michael Parkinson, and how, you know, listening to somebody that everybody loved, white people, everybody loved him the greatest, and listen to how he navigated that interview with Michael Parkinson and twisted him with intelligence. And I remember one of the things that stuck out in my mind was, in my memory, sorry, was him saying, listen, you can't beat me mentally and you can't beat me physically.
Interesting. I've never seen that.
I remember listening to that. But like, what was good about it was it made me realize, you know, to see a very intelligent black great man there and obviously very learned black man. And, you know, that made you think, I want to be like that. I want to be able to hold that conversation and put that back on you. So as then we can have the conversation where we can move on and go to a better place. Mm. And that's what it was. He did, because the questions that he was asking, it was almost like he was trying to test and belittle and that, and he was just too smart for that. And that is why, you know, I remember meeting him one time in Brixton, and then we came over and he kissed my hand. And I kissed his hand and he kissed my hand back. And it was when he's just getting to the place where he's just a little bit slow.
Yeah,
and that, and
yeah.
It was a moment, like, I don't know, touched me deep emotionally.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Help helps is a maxim I believe in. We all carry around stress and hardship, and when we keep it inside, it starts to chip away. Therapy is a safe place, and therapy is for everyone. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/Ruthie today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Ruthie. BetterHelp.com/Ruthie.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's that there?
They are grilled marinated peppers, which are, they're one of my favorite things that we're just starting to do.
Right.
They're on the menu every day now. So you blacken them off on the grill, steam them with a, you know, a lid over them,
yes.
Peel them back, and then you marinate them with loads of vinegar.
And is that just ready to go now?
Yeah, that'll be ready to go.
We might.
Yeah, we'll definitely give you a taste.
Yeah, I'll try one of those.
Harry, no pressure.
Nice one. Thanks, Lou.
Cheers. No worries.
So when you were growing up, mm-hmm. and you were in school, and mm-hmm. you were having your school food, and you were having difficulties, did you turn to any kind of food that would make you feel more comfortable?
I tell you what I did absolutely adore is sometimes you might go around to your friend's house on a Sunday, maybe after football, and we didn't have roast because, like I say, we had the rice and peas and chicken every Sunday without fail, to the point where I remember smelling the peas in the morning and just bursting into tears because I couldn't get the same thing. That's why I kind of went off kidney beans for many, many years.
Because?
I just didn't like the size of them. I didn't like the color of them. I just ate them too much, to the point I used to separate them from the rice when we were younger. I remember going to my friend's house, my white friend Johnny's house, and he had Yorkshire pudding. I never tasted anything so nice in my life. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
That was something that I craved. And I remember I used to say to my mum, can we have Yorkshire pudding? Can we have Yorkshire pudding? She would never get it.
Yeah.
We'd never have it, you know? So obviously when I got older, you get to a point, especially once I, you know, was able to afford it and stuff like that. Because like I say, getting to 2021, I was still eating the same stuff, doing the same things. But then when you start to kind of branch out with the world that I'm now traveling with the football club, and you're going to different places, different cultures, you start to eat different things. So now I will try everything, and like the same with Nance, I have to try something new.
One of the things of doing these podcasts and these talking with people is that many of them do measure success through their ability to have choice of food.
Yes.
So they can go to a restaurant, they can order a good glass of wine, they can order, and it's quite gratifying to see that no one is entitled. Yeah. You know, that people did not grow. Sam Taylor Johnson now describes exactly like you, being in a different queue for school food, which we know, shockingly, still goes on today.
Yeah,
I don't know if they put them in, you know, but the in separate lines, but the qualifications to have food. Mm. At the moment, we're working with a food group, and the aim with Jamie Oliver is to give children more nutritious food at lunch, because we know they're not going to have dinner.
Yes.
And what state of society is that, when you have to give children better food at lunchtime because that's the only meal of the day?
Well, this is why, you know, I mentioned like M&S, and I've got a campaign with M&S. And the reason I like them so much is because they're making it very easy for people to know what's healthy. Mm. You know, they have an Eat Well flour sticker. You can go into the shop, you see that sticker, and you know that that is an healthy option for you.
Right.
And so that's why, you know what I mean, I kicked onto that, because I didn't even realize when I was younger, eating healthy for me was not even, I was eating because you're hungry and you're eating to satisfy that hunger to be full.
Mm.
But now, like I say, with the options, you can go there and you can pick out something that is healthy because it's got the flour on it. You don't need to read through, because it's, you know, and that is another thing, you know. Nancy went through that. My wife, Nancy, went through all that. Excuse me, when she went through that phase where, you know, I hate going shopping in the end with her, because, like, she's reading everything.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's one of the things, what I believe that they should do, all of the big supermarkets, is they should make that easier for people.
Yeah, it's always in that tiny...
Absolutely.
Well, they don't want you to see how many chemicals
exactly
are in, you know, in the something that you're
having.
Which
is something we have to, everybody, you have to make sure that we're shining a light on that.
Mm.
Because we're getting the obesity rates, what they're talking about by 2030 are going to be, we're apparently in England, we're going to be like the most obese in Europe.
Mm.
We need to do something about that.
And obesity is very often related to poverty.
Yes.
It's not, as you don't see, if you don't walk it down in Belgravia, you don't see people who are overweight. If you go into a poorer section of London,
you
see people.
You do.
And that's because fast food, which is cheaper, has huge calories. You know, they bulk it up. So I think it's very important. Would you tell me about Arsene Wenger?
Wow. The thing with him, Rufy, is that he was, how can I say, a visionary.
Mm.
A visionary in the way he came and changed the diet.
What year are we talking about?
95, 96, when he got there. And, you know, food for Arsene Wenger was fuel to perform. He came in and he changed the diet from steak and chips and anything you wanted to proper food, like...
Mm.
Everything that is good for you.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing, what it was, with all the vegetables and the rice and the chicken steamed, you know, no seasoning, no salt.
Really?
No salt, no seasoning, no nothing. All we could do is drink water and eat this bland food.
Where was he from?
It's kind of Austrian French. He's on that border.
Mm-hmm.
And when he came in, it's the first time I realized that it's not about liking what you're eating. It's the fact that you have to be eating this for that slow sugar release that you need when you're performing at a level where you need your energy, and your energy has to be there constantly.
Mm.
This is why sweet things and certain things that just shoot you up like that during the game, you'll have to come down, because if you shoot up, you have to come down. So this is why pasta and broccoli and cabbage and carrots and all those vegetables, they give you that slow sugar that burns continually, so you can stay at a certain level and you can continue to perform. And it was very difficult at the start, but like when you started to see everybody doing it, and you could see, and obviously we had vitamins to go alongside that, but when you saw everybody starting to doing it and enjoying it, then they're taking it into their home lives.
Mm.
They do the same at home. Mm. And all of a sudden you're realizing this is for us to perform to the best of our ability, to the point where when you go to restaurants, you'd almost feel guilty to have anything that wasn't going to enhance you.
Yeah.
You know, Arsene Wenger, he had no problems after the game for you to have a sugar rush, like a donut or something.
Mm-hmm.
But then Monday, you've got to be back on that.
Right. So tell me about a day when you know that you're going to have a very, very important game, and you wake up, you open your eyes.
So obviously, first you wake up, and there's always water, because with Arsene Wenger, you had to have water with you all the time, right? You had to have very low-fat milk, you know, just very skimmed milk. You could have cereal, you could have yogurt, you know. So I'd have something like that, you know, no juices, nothing.
Nothing sugary.
Nothing sugary, nothing. Mm-hmm. on match day. So I'd eat something like that, something very light, skimmed milk, maybe some no sugar on Rice Krispies.
Right.
Or, you know, or even bran flakes.
Mm-hmm.
I have something like that. And that would take me through till, let me see, so we're playing at 3 o'clock, so we have to be eating by 12.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, what would we have? We'd all sit together and we'd have fish, which, and we'd have steak, and you'd have rice, and you'd have loads of like vegetables and water.
That would be too much at 12.
Yeah, so you'd eat that, and then that just starts to release and just go into your system.
Mm.
And then you're just topping that up with water.
Mm. And then at 3, you're on the pitch, and you do nothing except have water.
Just water and maybe one of those Lucozade drinks to give you a little bit of a sugary boost stuff. But like the main thing was to drink water. I can't emphasize how important it is to
Do you still drink a lot of water?
Yeah, I try. I still don't drink as much as I should now.
Do you lose weight when you're a footballer?
Yeah. Yeah, but you're lean.
Yeah.
Ruth, you're trim. Because remember, you're doing all that training, you're doing weights, you're doing the gym.
When do you do that? In the morning?
Every day.
When you wake up.
So when you go to training, again, you'd have that for your breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And then you train from 10:30 to maybe 1 o'clock, late 2 o'clock, depending on what stage of the season it's at. You train really hard. It's tough.
That's tough.
And then what happens is that you realize that if you're not eating right, you're not taking the vitamins right, you will see that you're lagging behind the guys who are doing it religiously.
Really?
To the point where, again, you go into a dressing room, Rufy, and, you know, it is very competitive. Very competitive, especially when you go into a dressing room where you're trying to attain and achieve everybody. The margins are very small. We'd practice and we'd train to a level where we say, well, they better be training as hard as we are, because if not, we are going to destroy them.
Yeah.
And that is what we were striving for.
And when Mr. Wenger's influence, did that reach other teams?
Yeah,
Was that something that anybody else realized that what you eat was what you are?
Well, what happened, Rufy, is that when we started to meet up with the guys when we went to England, you know, to select players from our team and then from Chelsea and from Liverpool and from Man United, and when you all met up, they all wanted to know, what are you lot doing?
Really?
What are you lot eating? What are you lot taking? Because our physio at the time was our physio, was the England physio as well. And Alex Ferguson was quite upset about it because he didn't like the fact that our physio knew what Man United players were eating, what Chelsea were, and he knew what to be able to tell Arsene Wenger.
Yeah.
So that he was really upset about that. But like, you'd sit down around the dinner table and they'd see us choosily picking what we want, because obviously we've got our physio there and he would make sure, you eat that, make sure you're not eating that, this and that. And you know what I mean? They would say, why aren't you eating this? And they say, well, we'll just eat this now.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now? Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. On Purpose's mission is to create impactful conversations to help you become happier, healthier, and more healed. This week, I talked to Tiffany Haddish in a hilarious, deep, thoughtful interview where we dive into family trauma, grief, sobriety, love, and dating. You'll be laughing, crying, and have so many impactful takeaways after this interview.
I had this, like, you know, homie lover friend for a long time. He's very disrespectful to me, very kind of messed up to me. But in my mind, we could get married. We had the most beautiful babies. He handsome. I'm pretty. Like, it would be so cool. He's smart and intellectual. I'm kind of smart, I think. Like, it would be fun. We have the best conversations. Like, we have fun, but then he would treat me like crap.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss this one.
The other day I was talking with a friend of mine who's an actor, and that there are actors who have to gain a huge amount of weight for a part or put on bulk. A friend of mine is going to be in a Marvel movie this summer, and he has to eat 8,000 calories a day to bulk up. You know? But it's so scientific, you know, that it's not like he can have an ice cream sundae or he can have whatever he can have. But it's nutrition now is become a science. To be a doctor doesn't depend on whether you're fat or thin. Mm-hmm. To be a teacher, but an athlete and an actor are the two kind of careers that actually, well, perhaps maybe an astronaut or whatever, but that you are dependent on actually training in a food
and
way.
The discipline, Rufy, to continue to do it, because, you know, you see these great actors who do that method, and they starve themselves, or like you mentioned, they bulk themselves up. Mm. And like the regime for that is exactly what we do for 9 months. Mm. Because again, it's the margins of what you're trying to achieve. And you know what I mean? Like you mentioned, you know, they've got to bulk up and 8,000 calories. I can't even imagine, you know, trying to eat that much. But you can imagine having to eat that much and not slipping up and not feeling one day, I can't do this today. Mm. You have to.
You have to. And tell me what you're doing now. Tell me what is in right day.
Well, it depends. Like, when the season's on, you know, obviously it depends if you have to go and do Match of the Day up in Manchester, or you have to go to Uxbridge to do the Premier League, or you have to go and do the work with the brands that I work with. Mm. You know, it's the typical days. Like, for instance, let's say I have to go to do Match of the Day. So the car will come and get you at 8 o'clock. You've got all your research stuff that you read on the way up in the car. Mm. Then you get there. And then you watch the games, and people see you on the TV at 10:30, and then you talk about everything what you've told the researchers you want to go out there. So then you do that, but it's a whole day.
And food? What are you eating?
Well, this is what I'm saying. With the food, you're able to order something in. And recently I found a really good West Indian shop, funnily enough, up there. I'll have that, or I'll have salad, some good vegetables, some nice rice and stuff like that, some fish.
What about as a family? Do you sit down for family
meals?
Now we
do, absolutely.
Yeah, how do you do that?
No, Nance would do the food. So we're probably eating in and around a 6:30-ish, 6:37-ish. And you know what I mean? By the time it's all done, we sit down around the table and we eat. And it's something where we get to talk about what's going on, what's happening in school, what you're doing. Yeah. Why are you so moody today?
Yeah.
Why are you so miserable? What's going on? You know what I mean? And I love it.
Yeah,
I love that. Yeah, I love that that we do sit down and we eat now. And I didn't realize when I was younger how important that was. But obviously friends used to do that a lot. And, you know, you took it for granted that that is something that is a necessity.
So you've just described a family that sits together, eats together, talks about their moods, talks about their emotions, are asked questions about what they're feeling. And that comes from not a role model that you had growing up, but for something that you and Nancy have created yourself. And tell me how that journey is.
Well, that's something that I think back about it, Rufy, and it makes me quite sad, because I look at, obviously, my mum, at my relationship, I should say, with my brothers and my sisters. You know what I mean? If we see each other, we see each other, we try and speak. You know, especially my brother Morris, speaks to him a lot, not so much with my brother Nicky, and I don't speak to my sister Dion at all. You know, we haven't got no connection to be together like that. Obviously, I have to make a lot of effort to even just with my brother. You know what I mean? Even he's got his car the other day. I said, "Now you know I'm busy, but just come up and see us." But like, what I've learned from it is how communicative we are now, and how that would have helped us if we was younger, if the emphasis was on sitting there and speaking about stuff. I could have maybe told her about some of the the rubbish that I was going through in respects of school and teasing and free meal. I don't know. But like now we can sit there with the girls and you're able to kind of like, without them feeling like you're interrogating them, you can ease out what's going on at school. And my wife is unbelievable in respects of her, you know, her personality and how she is and how she grew up, always sitting together, you know, with each other. So, you know, now that that is something that is, it's ingrained now, you know, it's something that we have to do that now, you know.
What you're describing is something that you're doing for many, many young people who listen to you, who watch you, who need your words and your social impact. As I said, from the very, very beginning, from people, the young people who work in the restaurant, they're not easily impressed, I have to say, but they really love it when you come in, when they see you and your kindness. And I think it's a kind of inspiration with them. And it goes to then my next question, which is a comfort to see someone who has achieved so much and is still, you know, talking to people who want to listen to them. So if I were going to ask you as our last question, before you go and have lunch, is if you have a food that you do turn to, not when you're hungry or you're tired or you, you know, want to share it with your children, but something that you personally, Ian, want for comfort, what would you go for?
At the moment, with the, like I mentioned M&S earlier on, but they recently, especially the last, I'd say, 8-9 months, Rufy, I'm like obsessed with profiteroles and cream. I cannot stop.
Eating. Do you like them with ice cream inside or cream inside?
No, cream inside with just double cream or single cream. And for me to just have in the car, which Nancy will hear about it now, I buy those Cadbury's mini rolls with the raspberry.
Oh, yeah. They've been around a long time. Are they wrapped in little foil?
Yeah, little foil. And those two at the moment are... No matter how much I've eaten, if somebody offered me a mini roll, I'll take it.
Okay.
And if somebody, like if we're having lunch and one of the girls leave, I won't leave a profiterole on its own.
Never.
It's like leaving a soldier behind.
Okay.
If my girls don't eat it, I'll say, you can't leave a soldier
leave
behind.
That. Okay.
That is basically it.
I will remember that. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
That was really nice. And what a great hour we've had, and I hope we have many more hours together. You know what? I'm going to ask you a favor.
Yes, certainly.
Will you take me to a football game?
Absolutely. You've got to come. And you know what? It's good because we're in the Champions League, Rufy. If you want to come, I'll take you to an Arsenal Champions League game.
I am coming.
The River Cafe Lookbook is now available in bookshops and online. It has over 100 recipes beautifully illustrated, with photographs from the renowned photographer Matthew Donaldson. The book has 50 delicious and easy-to-prepare recipes, including a host of River Cafe classics that have been specially adapted for new cooks. The River Cafe Lookbook, recipes for cooks of all ages. Ruthie's Table 4 is a production of iHeartRadio and Atomize Studios. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's Better, H-E-L-P.com.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.